to start, I'd like to give you an opportunity for you just to have a brief opportunity to take a moment for yourself. And perhaps you want to use the one talisman that you always have with you in every waking moment. That is your own breath. So just take a moment to focus on your breath and let everything else fade away. When I was in my first year of college, I began the transition from the religion of my youth to my own understanding of life's big questions. While I was in this transition, I encountered some of the most unusual spiritual guides in the most unusual place that to me, I could imagine. The guides found me in a small hobby shop where I worked in the Midwest. I worked there for several years, so by now I had the responsibility for going over the inventory of model airplanes and model trains and balsa wood and glue and writing up an order for a wholesale salesman who came in each week to take an order from us. We called them jobbers in those days, the wholesaler that came in. One day, I had an opportunity. One of the jobbers came in. It was the usual situation. It was a hot Midwestern day, and the jobber looks just about what your image of him probably looks like. He was unexceptional looking. He's in a wilted white shirt with a necktie loosely wrapped, knotted around his neck. And he'd probably driven 200 miles that day, going from store to store, collecting orders. And I've never been able to identify what I might have said or done that told him that I was on my spiritual quest. But at some point, he looked at me blankly, tore a piece of paper off of his order pad, turned it over, and began to write. He said, "Read these, no matter what else you read." The three readings that he gave me reference to were a book called Values Men Live by Morris Keaton, The Grand Inquisitor, from Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, and The Razor's Edge by W. Somerset Maugham. Now, Values You Live By, once you get past the painfully sexist title, is a sort of textbook of comparative religions, and it was written long before Joseph Campbell had his interviews with Bill Moyers that were later released as the book The Power of Myth. In Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, it's a short story within the book. It's one of the brothers talking to the others about how he lost his faith. And it's a vignette about what would have happened if Christ had appeared in his second coming at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. The stranger, as Christ is referred to in the vignette, is of course immediately thrown into prison as soon as he develops a following. And the vignette is a story about the Grand Inquisitor interviewing him when he's in prison. He tells the stranger that he doesn't really care whether he is Christ or not. He'll be executed anyway to protect the public and the church from the confusion that he might cause. Razor's Edge is a story about a young man's search for enlightenment, how he finds it, and how he pursues it, despite the personal cost to him in worldly things or in worldly terms. So I'm standing with this piece of paper in my hand in the store after the salesman has left. And the manager of the store, who was a family friend and who I'd known for many years, came up, noted my blank expression, and asked what had just happened. And I told him. And he says, "And The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. Don't forget The True Believer." So what I'm going to talk about today is The True Believer that Eric Hoffer wrote in 1951. But first of all, to kind of set the stage for The True Believer, there's you probably seen the movie Annie Hall in some years ago, and it closes with the narrator telling an old vaudeville joke. It says, a man goes to the psychiatrist and says, "Doctor, doctor, you've got to help my aunt. She thinks she's a chicken. She goes around all day clucking. She scratches at the carpet. She preens herself." The doctor says, "This is terrible. How long has this been going on?" The man says, "A couple of years." "A couple of years? Why didn't it come to me sooner?" "Well, we needed the eggs." Such is the power of the true believer. Most of us are skeptical and perhaps a little wary of believers, especially those we think of as true believers, people who by definition have a fervor or a zeal in a belief beyond reason. As an extension of our universals and especially our Unitarian heritage, we are very wary of people who don't respond to reason, at least who don't respond to our reason. Eric Hoffer was a New Yorker of German descent, born in the 20s, and lost both his parents at an early age. And he survived by his wits through the Great Depression and ended up as a longshoreman on the West Coast docks during and after World War II. His book, The True Believer, was written in the aftermath of World War II and was an attempt to understand fanaticism as a cause and a component of that war. There are many challenging ideas in Hoffer's book. One, that radical social movements grow when large numbers of us see our lives as meaningless and useless. Two, that fanatical movements tend to be interchangeable. He noted that in Europe, between the wars, the same people would go back and forth between the Nazis and the communists who were fighting in the streets. It wasn't the attractiveness of a particular ideology that brought the adherents. It was their own personal feeling of worthlessness and despair that motivated them. Third, he felt that these movements often concerned themselves with events and situations beyond the believers' own personal range of influence, which again he felt was a need to counteract the feeling of powerlessness that we often feel in our own immediate sphere of influence. If we are among the frustrated that feel that power won't come from within ourselves, because we have no faith in ourselves, no experience of empowerment. As a true believer, power comes from some magical leader or principle or some outside force in which we can put our faith. Hoffer's image of a true believer is a pretty dark image. He defines a true believer as irrational, exploitable, and part of an intimidating mass movement beyond the control of normal social and cultural regulation. These mass movements are composed of people convinced they are too weak as an individual to act without the movement. True believing, to Hoffer, is the opposite of freedom and justice. It is a kind of oppression and abuse because it distorts our most altruistic instincts into blind allegiance. So, if we don't want, or if we don't trust the true believer's misdirected fervor, where do we find and how do we release the energy and the zeal to do good? There is much in this world we would like to see change. What other power is there to move us to this action? As you use, we inherit a conception of a world where rationality and reason are a substantial part of our belief. As a group and as individuals, we tend to have bad experiences with faiths based on dogma and immutable texts and mythologies. As you use, we tend to see truth as evolving and maturing. The thing about seeing truth as evolving is you have to accept the idea that if you believe fervently in something, you may later see that belief as misguided or counterproductive as truth evolves. Things change. Generally, we see the best way to avoid this kind of conflict is to reserve our fervor, to reserve our zeal for the highest, most immutable principles we understand. For example, those expressed in the principles of the UUA. But sometimes that leads us to be too reserved, too cautious in our response to human needs. Now, Eric Hoffer's analysis of the true believer is in a very direct way the converse of Viktor Frankl's analysis. Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist, a neurologist, and a Holocaust survivor. His book, Man's Search for Meaning, was also published in the aftermath of World War II. Frankl saw the ultimate strength of any individual, the sole means by which he can survive in a chaotic and mortal universe, is the will to do what we can individually do at any moment and in any situation. Do what you can right here, right now. In this situation, Frankl says, the situation will tell you what to do and what is needed from you. Frankl said of his concentration camp experience, we had to teach the despairing men that it was did not really matter what we expected from life, but what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life, daily and hourly. Our response must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Life ultimately means taking responsibility to find the right answer to its problems, and to fulfill the tasks that it constantly sets before each individual. unquote. Yes, it is possible and worthwhile to have belief. The challenge is you have to believe in yourself. Both of these authors expressed one thought in two very different ways and from very different approaches. That thought is that the greatest loss that any of us can endure is to lose our personal faith in ourselves, to lose faith in our ability to influence our own destiny, to lose the faith that what I do influences what happens to me. If we think of this in the Hoffer's term, if blind fanaticism is a consequence of a loss of self-esteem, of a loss of feelings of our own worth, then the greatest gift we could give anyone is to revive in them a sense of empowerment. Once empowered, Frankl says, we will act to do whatever positive acts we can in any given moment, in any given circumstances. What a wonderfully positive image that is. Think of everyone doing what they can in any given moment, in any given situation, to do the best they can. None of us ever live up to our ability to do good acts in each moment. But if we maintain our sense of empowerment, if we are both humble and sensitive in our observations, we can do more than we ever thought possible. As a denomination, we seek justice, compassion, and truth itself. And these are important goals. If our good works are not to be condescending or even self-serving acts of charity that perpetuate the status quo, we must see the ultimate goal of our efforts as to empower everyone to do whatever positive acts they can in any given moment, in any given circumstance. We must really want everyone to have the opportunity to attend the same colleges and schools that our children do. We must really want everyone to have the power to decide where they want to live and how they want to earn a living. And we must dismiss the idea that any individual's influence and power provides them with any greater understanding of what we need to do at any moment, in any situation, than we have ourselves. We need to redirect those frustrations Pascal identified in our opening readings. Those frustrations are all caused by being convinced that we are not capable of doing good. Instead of letting our frustrations and failings and limitations motivate us to oppressive and destructive acts, let us act to reduce the frustration for all, for everyone, seeking to empower and heal all those who have lost faith in themselves. Just as when I open today, I often think about the debt that I owe, or the debt that I owe to those people that guided me years ago when I was seeking my own enlightenment. Because they witnessed, they declared to me a relative stranger, their personal philosophy so distinct from the mainstream of public thought where I lived. And by doing that, they freed me to find my own belief, one I could follow with fervor and courage. Theirs were small, humble acts, but they showed their understanding of what they needed to do in that moment. May we all be so liberated and yet so humble as they were.